From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As an actress, Liv Ullmann is best known for her starring roles in films directed by Ingmar Bergman. As a goodwill ambassador for UNICEF, she's traveled around the world, working on behalf of starving children. Now she's making her debut as a film director. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Liv Ullmann. Also today, writer Tracy Johnston tells us about facing Borneo's wildest river and the onset of menopause at the same time. She was prepared for one, but not the other. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Dave, the new comedy directed by Ivan Reitman, who also directed Ghostbusters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton was in suburban Chicago today trying to drum up support for his economic plan. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Bensonville, Illinois.
President Clinton held another campaign-style event today, speaking to students who packed the gymnasium of the Fenton High School in suburban Bensonville, Illinois. His speech focused on his plan to revamp the nation's student loan program and to begin a program of national service. It was always one of the best received of Clinton's campaign promises, but it's not at all certain that the national service plan can pass Congress this year. And there are other parts of Mr. Clinton's deficit reduction and investment program that are in trouble. Today, the president's spokesman, Dee Dee Myers, said that the White House knows that some details of the plan will be changed, but she said that's just part of the process, and she predicted that more of Clinton's program would pass intact than that of any other president. In Bensonville, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Clinton administration said today that its health care reform plans won't phase out Medicare coverage for the elderly and disabled. Ira Magaziner, the president's top aide on health care reform, said there are no plans to force Medicare recipients to change their doctors and move into managed care groups. Medicaid covers 32 million people over the age of 65 and 3.6 million disabled people. Magaziner said that over time, Medicare recipients will be given the choice of whether to join other health plans with the bill paid by federal Medicare funds. The Environmental Protection Agency says 819 American cities serving more than 30 million people have unsafe levels of lead in their drinking water. EPA officials say the new figures are a cause for concern, but not alarm. Environmentalists aren't so sure. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
At a press conference in Washington today, the EPA reported that in one-tenth of the country's medium-sized cities, tap water contains unsafe levels of lead. These cities are found all over the country, but they're clustered most heavily in the Northeast. Lead is a notoriously toxic element that impairs the development of children and raises blood pressure in adults. Unfortunately, the plumbing in many American cities is either lined or soldered with lead. The EPA plans to begin fighting these lead problems with public service ads urging residents to test their children for lead poisoning, drink more bottled water, and let the tap run for 10 or 15 seconds before using it for cooking. Environmental groups say that's not enough, though. They want the federal government to begin forcing offending cities to fix their plumbing systems as soon as possible. I'm John Nielsen in Washington.
Stock prices were up sharply today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 25 points to close at 3,468.8. The NASDAQ Composite Index was up 0.25 at 683. Advances led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR. The Senate ended a Republican filibuster today and gave final approval to a bill to make it easier to register to vote. The so-called Motor Voter Bill passed on a vote of 62-36 after senators voted to end debate on the measure. Republicans had fought to keep the measure from coming to a vote because many feared that liberal new registration procedures would result in the registration of more Democrats. The bill would allow people to register by mail or at state agencies such as welfare and motor vehicle offices. The African National Congress and the South African Communist Party have accused the police of not informing them of a possible right-wing plan to kill the chairman of the Communist Party, Joe Slovo. Tom Carver filed this report for the BBC.
The aim of the right-wingers appears to have been to assassinate Joe Slovo as he left his house to go to work. The Communist Party leader said the first he heard about the threat was when a journalist phoned to warn him what was going to happen.
The assassination was to take place with a hunting rifle from a post office tower, which is about 250 meters from the entrance of my house.
The police admit to having known about the plan for some time, claiming that one of the plotters was in fact a police spy. Police spokesman Colonel Johan Mostad said they alerted Joe Slovo and offered him police protection. This incident is a reminder of how delicately balanced the negotiation process is. Another successful assassination by the right wing would certainly tip it over into chaos.
Tom Carver in Johannesburg. British researchers said today that smoking doubles the rate at which people with HIV infections develop full-blown AIDS. The report was based on a small study conducted at a London hospital and found that smokers who were infected with HIV developed AIDS in about 8 months, whereas non-smokers fended off the disease for about 14 months. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many of us have carefully studied Liv Ullmann's face as framed in close-ups by director Ingmar Bergman. Her face expressed the subtleties of depression, despair, and confusion, the emotions that dominated the movies that Ullmann and Bergman worked on together, like Persona, Shame, Face to Face, and Cries and Whispers. Since 1980, Liv Ullmann has devoted less time to acting and more time to humanitarian work in her roles as Goodwill Ambassador for UNICEF and Vice President of the International Rescue Committee. She has a new movie, but she doesn't act in it. It's her debut directing a feature film. She also co-wrote the screenplay. The film is called Sophie, and it's adapted from a 1932 Danish novel set at the turn of the century. I asked Liv Ullmann what it was like to direct and be the boss on the movie set.
In pre-production with the actors, with the set designer, costume, makeup, and so I had no problem because we were kind of talking the same language, the same emotional language. But the first day on the set, the first day of shooting, it was hard because then I met a crew, I met people who deal with the technical aspects of a film, and they like to use their language, and their language wasn't always my language. And also, obviously, being a woman, as you may know too, from a working place, you have to prove yourself in a way that men don't often have to do. And so we had a week where, you know, there was this silent power struggle, and I won. But I had decided I don't want to win because I'm crying or because I'm emotional or, you know, having temper tantrums. I want to win by them respecting that I've done my homework, and since it's my script and my vision, they will finally understand that I know what I'm talking about. And they saw the rushes, and they saw how good the actors were, and without words, we put down the so-called little war and had a wonderful piece of 3 months where we danced together to my drum.
What was the power struggle about, and what did you do to win?
It's the usual power struggle, you know, that it's not easy for all men, nor for many women, to take directions from a woman. I also wanted on the set that there would be a kind of language, the way we talked to each other, on that it would be gentle and full of respect. And mainly I wanted the actors, you know, to be treated really warmly and nicely, so they would feel very safe, very trusted, so they could create, because I find that actors are creative. These were very established, wonderful theater actors of Denmark, and I wanted them to bloom. And to bloom, they cannot, you know, be told, well, hurry up, hit that mark, do this and that. And so there were some, you know, disagreements there, because sometimes they were talked to that way, and I had to make sure that that wouldn't happen again. And also there were a lot of technical, what do you say, words I didn't know. You know, to me, a camera can fly. To me, a camera can dance, and it can slowly come into a face, and you know, carries a body, and obviously that's not the dictionary used when you set up a scene, but that's how I spoke, and in the end they had to understand.
Did they laugh at you at first when you used this poetic language instead of more technical terms?
Sure, they laughed. And they would then use technical language far more than they needed to make sure I didn't understand them. And, you know, if you don't understand something, you don't even know you're supposed to make a decision. And that's how, not only in films, but in all fields of life, that sometimes women become strangers to what is going on because they do not really understand what the question is, nor that there is a question, because it's only when we, you know, talk the same language that we can share the responsibility of an answer. So they would make me sometimes invisible, and but that's when I didn't cry, and that's when I didn't storm out of the studio. That's when I stood there being invisible, saying, hello, I'm here, and, you know, whatever you think, we're going to do the shot my way.
Did you have to work to not cry, or was that just not the instinct in the first place? You know,
well,
sometimes when you say to yourself, I'm not going to cry, that's when you really weep.
I know. Well, yeah, I had to, because it would have been so easy to say, okay, take the responsibility now, you guys, for all this. I know you're so much better. Because it's in my nature to say, also a little, I'm sorry, you know, can I go and get you coffee while you do the important stuff here? But I knew I'll lose if I do it. And I had worked so hard on the preparation. I knew my stuff so well, and I had the hole in my head. Not the hole as a hole in the earth, but the
whole thing.
The whole thing in my head. So I knew nobody else had that. Because I'd been with this script for so long. So, I had to remind myself, don't cry, Liv. It's going to be fine. And it was fine.
Now, you've been directed by one of the most emotionally intense directors, Ingmar Bergman. Was there anything you tried to borrow or tried to consciously avoid based on your experiences as an actress being directed by him?
Well, you know, I think as in most professions in life, you learn more by those who do it bad than almost by those who do it well, because you learn by the bad ones what not to do, what makes you nervous, what makes you insecure. You know, that's not how I should deal with people. From the best ones, you don't really think, I have to remember this, I have to remember this. And although I made 11, I think, wonderful pictures with Ingmar Bergman, I've made so many more pictures with so many other directors and theater and writing, and I've been up and going for so many years. So as hard as it may seem for people to believe, I don't wake up and go to bed thinking, what would Ingmar Bergman have done and thought now?
What's the story of how you made your first film, Persona, with Ingmar Bergman, who directed it, and B.B. Anderson, who co-starred with you?
Well, I'd been an actress for many, many years, actually. Then in Norway, 8 years, and I was a leading actress in the National Theatre of Oslo. I'd done many Norwegian and Swedish films at that time, and I met B.B. Anderson on a Swedish film and went to visit her in Stockholm, and on the street we were walking and we met Ingmar Bergman, and like in the books, although it wasn't Lana Turner I was, Ingmar Bergman looked at me and said, would you like to do a film with me? And I thought that was a glib thing to say, and so I just blushed and said yes. And but the film then that he had in mind, where I had a small part, that never happened, because he became ill. But while in the hospital, he had kept this image of Bibi and me on the street, and he had seen a photograph of us and struck by our likeness. He was in the hospital and he wrote in a week a film, Persona, based on the likeness between two women, and that was Persona. And, you know, it was all came together, pre-production and everything, within 14 days, 3 weeks. Bibi and I was vacationing in Czechoslovakia when we got a fax to the embassy of Sweden, come back, Bergman is out of the hospital and eager to do a film with you. And we went back and thought we were doing this little film on an island in Sweden, and it turned out to be, you know, a really very special film in film history. Today many have made films like that, but at that time it was a first, and it's a classic film.
In Persona, you play an actress who is very depressed, going through like an existential crisis, and you've given up speaking. And B.B. Anderson plays your nurse. There are many scenes in which you're staring into the camera or staring just off into space, and there's just incredible intensity on your face, registering this absence, you know, this feeling of kind of groping for meaning. What were you thinking about during those long scenes in which the camera is just observing your naked face?
Well, I don't really know. You know, I've seen the pictures since then, and I was so young, actually, when I did it. I was 27, and the one thing I did understand was that I was doing Ingmar Bergman, and that's what I continued to do in a lot of the films. And just because he wanted to work with me, he made the role into a woman's role instead of a man's role. I was too young, really, to understand what an existential crisis was. And I was kind of a happy person, and it hadn't occurred to me that one has such crises. And today I understand much more. But I think my luck was that I somehow recognized Bergman and saw it's him I'm portraying. So I watched him, and I did him on camera.
What did you find in his face or in his body that you borrowed for that role?
Oh, this young boy. I saw a picture of him as a schoolboy when he was 11, and you can just see this boy doesn't have many friends, and he has all these pimples, and it's just somebody wanting to come out and say, hi, here I am, please see me. And that's what I saw in this grown man who was, you know, 21 years older than me. And I borrowed that. So if you say I'm looking intently into space and all that in Persona, I think I was trying to show this person, you know, wanting to communicate, wanting to be part of the world, but not knowing how to, and then deciding, I'm not going to speak, I'm just going to go into myself and hide from people. I can understand more of that today, not that I want to go inside and hide, but I can see how some people find it so difficult to live and to connect with others that they find it easier to just shut the door. It's sad, but I can see why some would make that choice.
It sounds like you understood shyness better than you did the existential crisis.
Probably. But, I think shyness is at the bottom of much existential crisis. Shyness in a deeper meaning, shyness where you feel so much on the outside, you feel everybody else have got it together, and you are the forever outsider.
My guest is actress and now director Liv Ullmann. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Liv Ullmann is my guest. She's directed the new movie, Sophie. Now, you and Ingmar Bergman became lovers. Was it ever a strain having a lover who was older and was also the boss, the director? I mean, it's sometimes an awkward position to be in, to have the person who you're most intimate with also be the person who's giving you directions.
Well, I tell you, it wasn't like living with Bob Hope. And you know, when we met for breakfast, tell me about his nightmares, I knew I was going to star in them in his next film. But and actually, we did Persona, and then I only did two films for him while we lived together. The bulk of the work we had done together was after our personal relationship was all over. But those two films, that was no fun, you know. The others, when the day was over, they could go and have fun and be together and so, but I had to go home with the boss, and this was really a boss, you know, in existential crisis. And yeah, that was kind of tough. And we lived on this island, and he built a house there where we had made Persona, and he built a wall around the house, and nobody would look in, but nobody could look out either. So it was some strange years there.
Was there ever literally a breakfast in which he told you about a nightmare and you did play that scene in a movie afterwards?
Yeah, actually it was. But many years after, actually the picture you mentioned earlier, Face to Face, where he told me, yeah, and an exact scene like a nightmare he had had at that time was in this film.
What was the scene? What was the nightmare?
Where the woman, which I played in Face to Face, who tries to commit suicide, she wakes up in her childhood bed. She's visiting her, I don't know who she was, must have been her mother. And she wakes up, and on the bed is sitting this strange woman with a glass eye, a black glass eye, just staring at her and then reaching out and trying to embrace her. And she screams. And she wakes up, and that was his nightmare. And yeah, that's what I got to do.
So was it more relaxing to act after your relationship with him had ended?
Yeah, well, I tell you, you know, he is not as dark as his films seem to say, nor, you know, while we're doing the films, even the dark ones. There is so much laughter and fun working with Ingmar Bergman. His films, except for Fanny and Alexander, which is the last one he did, are not showing so much of that really playful young boy that he has. But during filming, we had so much fun. Alan Josephson, who is also in Sophia, he's, you know, my best playmate. I can't tell you how during all these years we have been doing all these violent scenes, and then in between we are lying in a bed there on the set, you know, because it's always a bed because we're always married. And we just laugh away and tell jokes and secrets and badmouth the director and so. And that's why it was fun doing, or strange actually, doing Sophia, because here is Erland Josephson married to somebody else, Gita Nørby, the Danish actress he's married to in the film. And there they were, you know, lying in bed and laughing and going on. And I knew they were bad-mouthing me, I'm sure. And I couldn't be part of it. I had to kind of set up new shots and be on the other side of the camera. And it was very strange suddenly to see my playmate, you know, in his old role. And I suddenly had this new role of it. Director.
In 1980, when you started doing a lot of work for UNICEF, had acting started to lose its magic for you?
Maybe somewhat. At least some people that I was meeting during acting, you know, because you don't get to work only with wonderful directors like Bergman. You get to work with some bad ones too. And the older you get, the more impatient you are with listening to people doing bad homework. So, yes, I felt that for somebody who always said I want to really live life and be real in life, I was spending most of my time in film studios and on the stage and with makeup and so. And I was really, apart from being with my child and so, having very little time to do a life outside of the profession.
You wrote in one of your books, in describing yourself as an actress, you said, "I see myself as a sieve. Everyone's feeling flows through me, but I'm never able to retain them. In the evening, I'm put aside empty, only to be inundated the next day with new emotions." Can you compare that experience, that sieve-like experience of acting, with the experience of going around the world watching other people suffering?
Well, you're not a sieve there, and I must have been really affected by these Bergman films when I wrote that. That sounds, when you go around the world and you meet these strong, wonderful women who do so much for their community, who have so little and no reason to trust life, and in spite of that, trying to overcome. No, you're not a sieve. You just want to tell their story. You want to make their life better. You want to return to the riches of your own world and see how can we share this a little better. And when you see the suffering, you know, you cannot come home and say, "Oh, I suffer so much, I cannot sleep." They suffer, and your opportunity is to come home and do something about it. None of us can change the world, but all of us can, you know, make a ripple, a positive ripple, as opposed to all the negative ripples that we see around us. But no, you are no longer a sieve, and I think that's what is good. You retain.
You must really be struck by the contrast between movie values, especially Hollywood values in America, and the humanitarian work that you do. You travel around the world trying to help people who are starving or deprived in some way. And in Hollywood, I mean, actresses, once they get into the 40s, I have to start thinking, well, should I go for that plastic surgery or not? You know, and it's two such completely different sets of values and of seeing the world.
I know. And so I was probably very lucky that, you know, Hollywood didn't have a great love affair with me, because that never became my choice. I've always lived closer to reality than I would have maybe if I'd become an enormous big Hollywood star. And I think it's sad that especially we women who have fought so much, you know, to be respected for who we are, that we do feel we have to invade this temple or whatever we are and change the surface just to please the surroundings, that we, you know, that we don't encourage ourselves and others to take pride in who we are, who we grow into, you know, pleasure in a face that has been invaded by our tears and our laughter. And, you know, so we are not as young looking as we were, but we have a lot of stuff inside that, you know, if we leave our face alone, it's going to come out and it's going to look okay. You know, it's not shameful to do facelifts, but it's sad that we feel we have to do it. And especially, as I said, we women who fought so hard and still are fighting to be recognized for who we are, you know, not what we look like.
Liv Ullmann, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Liv Ullmann directed the new film Sophie. It opens in New York May 21st. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Writer Tracy Johnston expected to face difficulties when she went down Borneo's most treacherous river. She endured floods, foot rot, sweat-eating bees, and leeches. But she wasn't expecting the onset of menopause. Coming up, we talk with Tracy Johnston about what happens when an adventurer meets up with the truly unexpected. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Dave, the new political comedy starring Kevin Kline and Sigourney Weaver. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Bosnian Serb leaders have reportedly turned down a call by Yugoslav leaders for a meeting this Friday to talk about a UN-sponsored peace plan for Bosnia. According to the Yugoslav news agency, Bosnian Serb leaders decided to keep to their original plans for a weekend referendum concerning the peace plan. At the UN, the government of Bosnia has formally requested that the UN Security Council pull out all UN personnel. 2 weeks ago, a similar request was made and disregarded. Apparently, the Bosnian aim is to create conditions where a UN arms embargo can be lifted. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
Until now, troop-contributing countries have opposed Bosnia's request to lift the UN arms embargo. European countries like Britain and France have also resisted authorizing the use of U.S. airstrikes to force the Bosnian Serbs to sign a UN peace plan. They argue that either measure would expose their peacekeeping troops to retaliation by the Bosnian Serbs. In a letter to the Council, Bosnia's foreign minister says that the UN troops have now become an impediment to the country's ability to defend itself, and as such, he requests that they be withdrawn. Diplomats pointed out that the presence of the 9,000 UN personnel has been authorized by the Council. However, diplomats want to avoid the impression that the UN troops are in Bosnia against the will of the government, that the UN force has turned into a humanitarian army of occupation. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
On Capitol Hill, the Senate Armed Services Committee continued hearings today on lifting a ban on gays in the military. Retired Army General Norman Schwarzkopf told the panel that lifting the ban would have a serious impact on the armed forces. NPR's Martha Raddatz has more on the story.
General Schwarzkopf said he sympathizes with gays who are mistreated, but said emphatically there is no room for homosexuality in the military. He said he knows many officers who would leave the service if gays were allowed to serve openly. Following Schwarzkopf's testimony, former Air Force Staff Sergeant Thomas Panacea told the panel of his gut-wrenching decision to disclose his homosexuality, a move that caused his discharge.
It is the human element that is at the heart of this issue, the human cost, the wasted talent, and the pain and suffering of many, many people. I believe the current ban on gay, lesbian, and bisexual Americans runs counter to the highest ideals of our military and what our military strives to uphold.
Panacea said when he told his fellow airmen that he was gay, they accepted it and did not let it affect the cohesion of the squadron. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 25 points to close at 3,468.75 on volume of 218 million shares. This is NPR News. President Clinton met today with a group of high school students in Illinois, and he called for support of his plan to change the nation's college loan program. Mr. Clinton's program to allow students to pay back part of their loans through community service was applauded by students in suburban Chicago. However, the plan to have the government loan money directly to students is under attack by the banking industry and loan service groups. The president says that doing away with middlemen in college loans and cracking down on loan defaults could save about $4 billion over 5 years. Israeli Prime Minister Rabin has been given a one-week respite from a crisis that threatens to bring down his 10-month-old coalition government. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Just moments before the resignation of ultra-Orthodox Interior Minister Aryeh Deri was due to take effect, a temporary compromise was reached. Both Deri and outspoken Secular Education Minister Shulamit Aloni will deposit their portfolios with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin for 1 week. In that time, Rabin will try to negotiate a compromise. The crisis began when Deri and his Shas party insisted that Aloni, who they see as anti-religious, be removed as education minister. They also insist that no other minister from Aloni's left-wing Meretz bloc replace her. If no compromise is reached, Prime Minister Rabin becomes dependent on five Arab and pro-communist members for a narrow one-seat majority in the Israeli Knesset or parliament. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
According to officials in Thailand, more than 200 people died in a fire yesterday at a doll factory near the capital. Most of those who died in the fire were women. Several thousand people worked in the facility, and most were young women. Fire officials say that part of a staircase collapsed in the blaze as workers were trying to get out of the burning building. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Talk about your basic midlife crisis. Tracy Johnston was on an expedition down the wildest river in Borneo when she had her first menopausal hot flashes. Johnston is a journalist who was invited by the Sobek Adventure Travel Company to participate in the first descent down Borneo's Bow River. The company hoped to open the river to commercial rafting. The river has an 18-mile section that funnels through a steep, narrow gorge. Local guides said the rapids in the gorge were unrunnable. No one had done it before. As the team was about to start the run, a woman from a Borneo village said a prayer for the misguided white people who were going to die in the gorge. Johnston's book, Shooting the Bow, is about the adventure down the Bow River and about the less-than-thrilling discovery that she was the only person over 40 on the expedition. I asked her what she expected when she signed up.
I thought it was going to be a modest adventure. I knew it was an exploratory river trip and that the river had never been run before, which meant that there might be some surprises. On the other hand, I had read the catalog, the Sobek catalog, which described the trip as of average difficulty. So that kind of clung on to that description. You know, average, certainly I could handle.
Was it of average difficulty?
Well, let's just say, that Sobek is not offering the trip anymore. It was really, we were one emergency away from disaster, I'd say.
What is the river like, the Bow River in Borneo?
Well, the Borneo is right in the equator, and there's really primary tropical hardwood rainforest all around it. And the part that we were going through was a 20-mile section called the Bow River Gorge, and it was surrounded by steep rock walls on both sides. And the water there, I don't know why we didn't really know this, I guess because we didn't have time to scout it. The water was really almost one continuous journey of white water, frothing white water. It was very damp and humid and fetid in the gorge like it is in any rainforest. And also we found out what happens to rivers in a rainforest when it rains. There's no soil really on the ground, and so all of the water just pours right into the river off the gorge and off all the mountains. And in fact, there was one time when we were really in quite a desperate situation because the river was beginning to flood. It rose about 2 feet in 10 minutes, and we realized we'd have to find a place to get out, to get up to high ground, and that wasn't always possible on this river. Now, luckily, at that point, we did, and then the story of what happened to the river when it flooded is another amazing story, but the river really did become a kind of personality on the trip, as does the rainforest.
Now, you describe yourself as the oldest and the weakest person on this trip. What did it mean to be the oldest and the weakest?
Well, the oldest meant being over 40. The weakest meant, not sure I was the weakest, but I did have a bad back problem. In fact, for the first time in my life, my back had been thrown out and about 2 weeks before the trip. And so I knew that I had to, especially when we got in this dangerous situation in the gorge, I knew that I had to do anything to keep myself in good shape. The worst thing would have been to have somebody who, couldn't move, had a bad back.
We should mention the bursitis, too, shouldn't we?
Yeah. Right. Yes, I've done a lot of traveling and slept on a lot of hard floors and a lot of rocks, but I've always had an air mattress because I do have this bursitis in my hips, and it just hurts to sleep on my side. And because of this back problem, I couldn't sleep on my back. So yes, I was, as you know, I was inordinately worried about an air mattress. You know, I'm sure now that I think of it, I could have made it without an air mattress. I did learn from this trip that you can withstand a lot of things that are not comfortable, more than you would imagine, actually.
Well, what I wonder is, when you're there and you're facing the terror and you're risking your life, do you ever ask yourself, well, what am I risking it for? I mean, it's this journey that I'm going to write a magazine article about. Okay, it turned into a book. But, I mean, do you know what I mean? You're not there to save lives. You're not there to, like, defend your country or even defend your family. You're there just for the sake of it, you know? And so when you're facing your own death just for an adventure that has no point beyond adventure, what do you tell yourself?
Well, I know what I tell myself. There was actually only one point in the trip where I thought I was going to die, and that was again when I had the boats had overturned, and I was really trapped at the bottom of a waterfall, and I was just held there, held in place, out of breath, gulping air, and I know exactly what I thought. It was exactly the same thing that you said. Oh, you know, God, I'm going to die because of this stupid river trip. But then the rest of the time, I didn't feel that I was going to die. I mean, there wasn't terror. We were trying to make our way out of the canyon. It was uncomfortable. But I was cautious. I was never in a situation in which I wasn't in control in terms of just walking, traversing the river, and whatnot. But yes, I agree. I thought that very thing, you know. Oh, you know, this is really, really dumb.
So
you know, forget it, I guess, like childbirth or something. You just forget it.
Tracy, let's take a break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about what it was like for you to go through the early stages of menopause while going down the Bow River in Borneo. Tracy Johnston is my guest. She's the author of Shooting the Bow, A Woman's Voyage Down the Wildest River in Borneo. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tracy Johnston, author of the new book Shooting the Bow, about her voyage down the wildest river in Borneo. Tracy, in your book you have a little inventory of your physical condition, of all the bites and funguses and so on that plagued you at one point during your journey. Let me ask you to read that inventory for us.
Okay, yeah, this is basically what happens to you if you have to spend any amount of time at all in a rainforest. Before I went to sleep, I made a written inventory of my physical condition. Feet, covered with red spots, particularly under my left arch. Dark red sores between my toes with stinging, broken skin. Foot rot arrested, but not gone. Ankles. Right ankle swollen for some reason. Left ankle has an open sore on it. Have to beg for some antiseptic. Legs. Four dark bruises on my left leg and a huge welt behind the knee. A spider bite? Two dark bruises and a bump and gash on my right shin, plus a line of poison something on my calf, oozing and itching like crazy. Arms. A new rash on my right arm. Hope it isn't the same poison thing. Two immense bites, one on each arm, still swollen, about 2 inches. Hands. A splinter festering in my thumb, 8 fingernails broken. Mouth. The sore on my gum, neither better nor worse. Mind. Mildewed, lethargic, maybe rotten. Heart, love you, John.
And John is your husband.
John's my husband, yeah.
Who was at home wondering why the heck you were on this voyage in the first place.
He was.
Okay,
thank God they didn't call him when we were a week late. I don't know what he would have done.
So here you are, your body's kind of falling apart. So is everybody else's on the trip. And to top it off, you start having the symptoms of menopause. You're going to sleep at night and having hot flashes.
Yeah, and, you know, this was before Gail Sheehy's book. This was before anybody was, like, mentioning the word menopause. In fact, I had never talked about it with any of my friends. I knew that I was beginning to go through the early stages of it, but I hadn't experienced hot flashes before. And in the middle of the Bow River Gorge, where it was unbelievably hot, we were right on the equator, I started having hot flashes. At first, I didn't know what they were. All I knew that I would get incredibly hot and all the sweat-eating bees would start buzzing around me and landing on me. And when I finally realized what it was, I was embarrassed and I was almost ashamed. I certainly didn't tell anybody on the trip about it. They were all much younger. I don't think they would have been interested. I really decided to write about my personal journey as well as the physical one on the Bow only when I came home. And I thought at the time, you know, that this is ridiculous to be so ashamed of this because it happens to every single woman. So I tried to examine not only the hot flashes that happened to me, but the whole kind of confrontation with middle age I had on this trip. In many ways, it was a crisis of self-confidence, and in some ways that was even worse than the physical journeys for me.
Were you embarrassed to tell other people about it because it meant you were getting older? Or because it was just so personal?
I guess because it was personal and nobody, I'd never talked with it about anybody about it. I never talked to anybody about it myself, not even my mother. I thought it was something people didn't talk about, which they didn't, really. And also, I didn't want them to know how old I was.
Why not?
I do know that ageism exists. I felt it in various jobs and also. And I didn't want the guides to have to worry about me. They were kind of close to exhaustion, and they were really, you know, doing enough, and we were all trying to help them as much as we could. We also weren't a very close-knit group. You know, a lot of people think, oh, my God, you must have bonded with these people. They must be your best friends now. And the fact is that that really wasn't true. We felt that somehow talking about our old lives, about, you know, the magazine I used to edit or the kind of a lawyer that John was or Sylvie's fashion design styling, just seemed kind of silly. It seemed kind of jarring in the midst of this pure kind of rainforest and this pure adventure. And so we spent a lot of time just being silent together. And when things began to get a little serious, we all sort of turned inward. So it wasn't the kind of thing where I felt, you know, naturally that I would confide in someone.
So did you recognize what the hot flashes were when they happened? Or did you just think, whoa, what a hot night?
Yeah, that's what I thought at first. Like, why are these bees? What's happening? You know, why are these bees pestering me? Yeah, and I would wake up, and they really were something. I would wake up in this little, finally, after about a 6 day in the river, we found enough room to actually set up tents. And having a hot flash in a tent in the tropics when it's raining and musty and your flashlight doesn't work anymore, so you can't really wander around outside. And if you went and sat down outside to try to get some cool air, there'd be leeches that would come after you. That was not a pleasant experience, just kind of lying there fanning myself. But yeah, I finally figured out what they were. I mean, I said, these seem to be hot flashes to myself, and then I got it. Oh, yeah, hot flash.
Now, you also started to obsess almost about losing your looks, about, you know, getting older, not looking good anymore. And it struck me, I both understood it, and it also struck me as a kind of strange place to be worrying about your looks, considering everybody had, like, feet and arms and noses and mouths that were swollen like crazy because of fungal infections and insect bites. I mean, it's hard to imagine anybody looked particularly good on the trip, or maybe that anybody even cared how other people looked.
Ah, but there was Sylvie.
Yes.
Remember, there was Sylvie on the trip, and before Sylvie, there was Olatz. There were two extremely gorgeous women on the trip.
And she's from the fashion industry.
That's right. One, they both had been models. One was a full-time international class model, and she had the good sense to leave just before we got on the river. But Sylvie stayed, and Sylvie was a fashion stylist, and, you know, it was interesting. I thought of her after a while as kind of like a beautiful bird or animal, and I watched her a lot of the time, and then she began to have an affair with the gorgeous guide on the trip, and it was all very French in that it was very open, and she would kind of nuzzle him, and their long, beautiful limbs would entwine as they sat by the fire. So there was a lot of time to think about beauty and about what it gets you. And there's also on this trip, I realized that on adventures in my life, I had usually counted on some man or another to want to help me, you know. And on this trip, they didn't really. I was alone. I was out, didn't have a buddy. And the guides really, I must say, were pretty exhausted. But, you know, I remember there was one time when I had gone into the woods to take for a bathroom stop. And when I came back, all the rope was gone for people to set up shelters because it was beginning to rain. And I went to a guide and told him about it. And I realized that in the past, I would usually count on somebody saying, well, you know, you can come sleep beside me or I'll help you. And Dave, this time, he said, well, just get a tarp and just sleep under it. Just let it lie over your face, you know. And I said, what? And I realized that I was on my own on this trip. I had to go find rope and build a shelter, that Mike was helping Sylvie, but that I did not have, just from having youth, really, and not overwhelming beauty, but just being kind of young and pretty, that I had gotten a lot. And, you know, I hadn't been able to admit that, or I hadn't really thought about that, that it had gotten me something that I wasn't going to get anymore. Gotten attention. I had certain perks from it. And perhaps because we had a lot of time to think and because I wasn't looking in the mirror and because there wasn't any mirror along, but I just had a lot of time to think about that, and I realized that it's something I hadn't thought about before, and it was kind of scary, actually. What was I going to do? Was I going to be wittier? Was I going to be smarter? What was I, you know, or were I just going to get less attention in general from people in life?
Do you still feel that now that you're, you know, you're out of the bow, you're out of shooting the dangerous rapids and so on?
Well, yeah, I do. In fact, I had, it was really interesting. I had to, another thing I thought about there was, okay, if I'm not going to do these physical adventures anymore because I realize I'm getting too old to do them and I can't really rely on help, what am I going to do for adventure? And luckily, the magazine article that I was going to write became turned into a book because that became my second adventure, and that doesn't require any men to help me. You know, I did it all on my own, as I ultimately did the bow on my own too. But I thought a lot about the second half of your life and what are those adventures, what are those challenges going to be, and in a way, it's more frightening. They're going to be emotional challenges, intellectual challenges, spiritual challenges. They're all, kind of, I'm all a little terrified of them, but also anxious to begin and try and take them on. And I've also found that that there is one wonderful thing about older people. I went on another river trip just as kind of R&R after this one on the bow, and Sobek said they'd send me for free in this lovely placid river trip. And I went there, it was in Sumatra, and there were some older people on the trip. And, you know, the conversation was so good. The conversation was so much better than it was on the bow. And the people had lots of life experience, they had wisdom, they were smarter, and I realized that there are wonderful things to growing old and sharing things with people your own age.
Tracy Johnston is the author of Shooting the Bow. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton is on the road. Linda Wertheimer, are you following his trip on All Things Considered?
Mara Liasson is following the president, Terry, and will be reporting. He was in Illinois today selling his economic plan, discussing revisions. We'll have a report also on the business community's response to that, and a report from Washington on gays in the military. General Norman Schwarzkopf testified on that subject on Capitol Hill today. And today is the first of our reports on how people in Serbia are responding to the war in Bosnia. Noah Adams has a long piece which looks at that question from the point of view of Serbian people.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Ivan Reitman doesn't make very many movies, but when he does, they're usually comedies with one-word titles that become hits, like Stripes, Ghostbusters, Twins, and Meatballs. His latest picture could follow suit. Film critic Stephen Schiff had a look at Dave.
Dave is a movie about an imposter, and there's been a lot of that going around, what with King Ralph and Summersbee and Sister Act and Splitting Heirs. In some ways, the formula always works. It's always fun to see the fish out of water flopping madly. But imposter movies can also be a kind of wish fulfillment fantasy. If only things didn't have to be business as usual. If only a simple outsider like you or me could sneak in there and make everything work. That was certainly the mood that buttressed Ross Perot's and even Bill Clinton's campaigns for president last year. So Dave benefits a lot from sheer timing. It presents a bland, technocratic president, Bill Mitchell, who's played by Kevin Kline, with more than a little reference to George Bush's gangling walk and twisty frown. Meanwhile, Kline also plays Dave, a sweet schlub who runs a temp agency and happens to look exactly like the president. This trait is not lost on the Secret Service, who discover Dave and hire him to impersonate the president on an evening when the great man wants to sneak away to enjoy the attentions of his comely office assistant. Trouble is, those attentions turn out to be too strenuous, and President Mitchell has a massively debilitating stroke in her arms, which is when the scowling chief of staff, Bob Alexander, played by Frank Langella, springs into action. He arranges for Dave to take over the Oval Office, while he, Alexander, twiddles the strings. Dave makes a nice president, visiting centers for homeless children, smiling cheerily, performing magic tricks. Meanwhile, Alexander is secretly vetoing bills funding those centers for homeless children. The First Lady, played by Sigourney Weaver, naturally thinks the president is behind those vetoes. And besides, she hasn't been on friendly terms with him for years.
You know, if you want to be the same old selfish bastard, go ahead, I've gotten used to that. But don't put on this man of the people routine and then do something like this.
I don't understand.
You know very well that was not a works bill that you vetoed. That would have given those children homes. When I think of that spectacle you put on with the little boy and the magic trick.
Wait a minute, what's wrong with the magic trick?
It was some magic. You made their funding disappear.
Up to this point, the movie has been mild and familiar and fun. Kline's two performances are distinct and carefully drawn, and if there's nothing terribly convincing about the White House atmosphere, there are enough cameos from real-life politicians and media titans to make things jolly. But then the movie goes off the rails. Dave decides to use his position to do those good, common-sense things that we all would do if we were president, like help the homeless and give people jobs, and it's as though no one ever thought of doing this stuff before. When the pace slows to a poke and the jokes stop coming and the First Lady, who's on to Dave now, falls in love with him, you realize that this movie is a lost cause. What could have been a sharp send-up of how power corrupts becomes the feeblest of political daydreams. Bill Clinton saw it the other night and said he enjoyed it immensely. I'll bet he did. Watching Dave's jobs bill sail through Congress must have been for him a wish fulfillment fantasy of the highest order.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor James Belushi. He's starring in ABC's futuristic miniseries Wild Palms, produced by Oliver Stone. Belushi plays a television executive who gets caught up in the computer-generated illusions that his network broadcasts. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.